It's a great opportunity. I'll be giving one talk today and another talk again on Tuesday. It's largely the same material, but I'm going to give a slightly different focus. So today we're going to focus mostly on the holographic side of the story, and I'll give you a fairly brief summary of the cosmological implications. And on Tuesday, I'll focus more on the cosmological implications and give a quick overview of the holographic side of the story. So this is work with Costas Skenderis, and we have two papers out on the subject, and there'll be more to follow. So yeah, so in a nutshell, the idea is we're trying to apply holography to cosmology. So holography states that any quantum theory of gravity has a dual description in terms of a quantum field theory without gravity that lives in one dimension less. So, sorry, is it too loud? No. So the concrete examples, the concrete realizations we have of holography in string theory, they all involve spacetimes with a negative cosmological constant, ADS-CFT. But the arguments in favor of holography apply more generally, and in particular, they should apply towards the cosmological evolution of our own universe. So today, I'd like to tell you about a new framework we're proposing that enables you to do holography for cosmology. And in particular, we're going to be looking at inflationary spacetimes. So we're going to try and construct a holographic framework to understand inflationary cosmology. So specifically, what this means is we'd like to have a dual description of a four-dimensional inflationary spacetime in terms of a three-dimensional quantum field theory without gravity. And we're going to see today how we can reconstruct cosmological observables, such as the primordial power spectrum, from calculations involving only the dual quantum field theory. So first of all, let's think about this framework, the two ingredients that any holographic framework for cosmology must have. First of all, you have to tell me precisely what is the quantum field theory that's dual to cosmology. Secondly, you have to give me a recipe for computing cosmological observables in terms of the correlation functions of the dual quantum field theory. So the cosmological observable we're going to focus on today is just going to be the primordial power spectrum. Obviously, we have very good experimental data on this on the WMAP satellite and other cosmological probes. So having defined a duality between holography and some dual quantum field theory, between cosmology and some dual quantum field theory, first of all, you've got to be able to recover standard inflationary predictions in their regime of validity. So in other words, when you can do a perturbative quantization of fluctuations about some background spacetime, you ought to get back standard inflationary results. So this is the regime where the gravity description is weakly coupled and the dual quantum field theory is strongly coupled. So this takes us to a key feature of holographic dualities. So it's almost the distinctive feature of holographic dualities. You have these two theories. You've got a gravitational theory and you've got a quantum field theory. And in the regime where one description is strongly coupled, the other is weakly coupled, and vice versa. So if the gravity description is strongly coupled, the dual quantum field theory is weakly coupled. If the dual quantum field theory is strongly coupled, then the gravitational description is weakly coupled. So the point about this is that, this is the whole point of holography. It's extremely powerful because we can understand the strongly coupled regime by looking at the dual regime, which is weakly coupled. So my feeling is the whole point of doing holography for cosmology, certainly the major motivation for me is, let's try and understand this regime where the gravitational description is strongly coupled at early times. And we can understand such a theory, such a scenario, by looking at the dual quantum field theory in the weakly coupled regime. So this is what we're going to try and do. We're going to obtain new results by looking at the regime where the gravitational description is strongly coupled at early times, and the ordinary inflationary description breaks down. You can't perturbatively quantize fluctuations around this background. But the point is that in this regime, the dual quantum field theory is weakly coupled. So that's how we can make predictions. That's how we can understand this strongly coupled gravity at early times regime. No, but you have to have a notion of a classical background geometry about which you perturbatively quantize small fluctuations. In this strongly coupled gravity regime, you don't even have a gravitation. Basically, the strings. Well, it is important because basically, the predictions of standard inflation, you have to have this background about which you can perturbatively quantize small fluctuations. We're going to find this strongly coupled gravity regime, even the metric description of spacetime breaks down. So we're going to obtain, basically, we'll see at the end of the talk, we're going to obtain predictions that are qualitatively different to standard inflationary scenarios.
Yeah, so maybe that's what's confusing. So maybe you're not talking about standard slow-roll inflation at times late in quantum, you're talking about something like inflation happening at quantum times, where the gravitational field is strong,
might be strong. We'll see a little bit later in the talk what I mean more precisely. Basically, the idea is that at very early times, so in the holographic theory, there's this there's the number of, they're sort of gauge theories, SUN type gauge theories, and there's this parameter n, and in the Atoff limit where n is large, then, so there's two parameters. One is this sort of Atoff coupling, there's n, the number of colors, and there's also this Atoff coupling lambda. And basically, when the Atoff coupling lambda is large, so the QFT is strongly coupled, then a gravitational description applies to the bulk. And in the opposite limit, where the Atoff coupling is small, then basically the string scale and the ADS scale are comparable, and you have to go to a full string theory dynamics of the bulk. But we're going to see how we can understand the behavior of the cosmology of such a scenario just in terms of using the dual QFT. So we'll come back to all of this later in the talk, so perhaps we'll just put this to one side for now. But the point is, yes, the punchline is we're going to see how to compute cosmological observables holographically in terms of the dual QFT, which is weakly coupled, so we can use perturbative QFT. And we're going to obtain qualitatively different predictions from standard inflation that are nonetheless compatible with all current observational data. How long that will continue is a very interesting thing we'd like to know. So the plan of the talk is as follows. So basically, I'm going to explain, first of all, this is our framework for doing holography for cosmology. So the first part of the talk is I'm going to talk you around this square from corner to corner and explain our holographic framework for cosmology. And then the second part of the talk, which will be somewhat more brief, I'm going to explain how we obtain cosmological results in this regime where gravity is strongly coupled at early times. So let's first of all begin. So this is our framework. So the top part of this diagram, this line here, corresponds to standard holography. You have a spacetime with negative curvature, for example, an asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime that describes a holographic normalization group flow. And under standard gauge gravity duality, standard holography, this is mapped to a quantum field theory in one dimension less. Now, so holographic RG flow spacetimes, things like asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, they have negative curvature. Inflationary cosmologies have positive curvature. To go between the two, go between the inflationary cosmology and a spacetime that has a holographic interpretation, we're going to have to do a sort of analytic continuation of variables. So this is this domain wall cosmology correspondence I'm going to explain in a minute.
So what is the domain wall? What is the geometry of the domain wall corresponding to the ADS stuff?
I will give you precise definitions of everything as we go on. I'm just trying to give you an overview of the structure first. So basically, the top line is standard holography. The left-hand side of the diagram is the gravitational description. This is the gravity side of the correspondence. You've got a domain wall, you've got a holographic RG flow spacetime, and you've got a cosmology. So this is the gravity side of the description. The right-hand side of the diagram, this is the quantum field theory side of the description. So you've got the QFT that's dual to the holographic RG flow spacetime. And the bulk analytic continuation we did to map between the holographic RG flow and the cosmology, when you translate that into dual quantum field theory variables, that corresponds to a certain analytic continuation of QFT parameters that takes you between the quantum field theory and this new modified quantum field theory that we're going to call a pseudo-quantum field theory, for lack of a better name. So the analog of the usual gauge gravity duality is this duality between cosmology and this pseudo-QFT that we're going to see. So now I'm going to talk you around this diagram in more detail.
So just a question. So I understand that this is a natural way to proceed and then get a connection, but I mean, at the end of the day, when you're done, this is a way to know to playing quantum field theory to cosmology,
yes,
through a new way of understanding things?
Yes, so there's two ways to think about it. When the gravity description is valid, then you would you'd go around the diagram like this. So you start off with your cosmology, you do this analytic continuation of gravity variables to take you to this holographic RG flow spacetime, and then you'd use ordinary holography to map you to a QFT. Now, what I'd like to do is go to the opposite regime where the gravitational description is strongly coupled, and you should do everything from a QFT point of view. So in that case, you start off with your QFT correlator, which you compute. You do this analytic continuation of QFT variables to go to the pseudo-QFT, and then you use the map we worked out to take you to cosmology. So the idea is that in the regime where the QFT description is weakly coupled, you go like that, whereas in the regime where the gravity description works, you can go like that.
Well, actually, what I was asking is, after you've learned what you have to in order to do this kind of description, can you come up with a new dictionary that would take you from cosmology to QFT? Assuming that you go through the standard ADS CFT correspondence.
I suppose the point is that we're going to use the standard, the standard ADS CFT setup to work out the mapping between cosmology and QFT, and then we're going to assume that the same mapping holds when the QFT is weakly coupled, and we can go this way around. We'll see all of this. This will all become more clear as I explain further. I'm just trying to give you an overview of the.
So, in a diagonal, you will not be able to prove that you can go from cosmology to QFT directly, as it will show that by. Because of the duality between the first two blocks. It is important to go to the holographic RG flow.
Yeah. Let's. Perhaps I'll just. I'll talk. This. Yes. This will all become clear. I'm really just trying to give you an overview of the structure of what we're trying to do. So now I'm going to talk you around each aspect of this diagram in more detail. So cosmology. Let's just start off briefly. This is a mixed audience. I'd like to just briefly review how we compute things in standard inflation, how we compute the power spectrum, and so forth. So just to set the notation. So for simplicity, let's just consider single field inflationary models in four dimensions. You can generalize all this later on if you wish, but this is just the basics. And we're going to assume a spatially flat background that fits with the data, and we're going to do linear perturbations. And, you know, as you probably all know, when you look at linearized perturbations, there are basically three dynamical degrees of freedom. You've got the transverse faceless tensor modes, gamma ij, and then you've also got the scalar modes, and basically you can mix the scalar path and metric perturbations and the inflaton perturbation, and it's useful to form this gauge invariant combination zeta defined here. Zeta is a very widely used variable in cosmology. Basically, it's conserved on superhorizon scales in the absence of entropy perturbations. So it's a very useful variable, and it's gauge invariant. So physically, this variable zeta, it represents a curvature of spatial slices that are co-moving with the matter. So if you find a spatial slice where the inflaton perturbation vanishes, zeta tells you about the curvature of that spatial slice. So you go away, you work out the equations of motion for the perturbations, and they both obey very similar looking sort of wave equations. You know, H is the Hubble rate, and then this is the slow roll parameter. We're not assuming slow roll. Epsilon can be anything here. But these are the equations of motion obeyed by the perturbations. And again, as you're well aware of, in the inflationary paradigm, quantum fluctuations originate as, cosmological perturbations originate as quantum fluctuations on sub-horizon scales, and then they're stretched out by the accelerated expansion of space-time to large scales. So if you want to work out the power spectrum, you can work out the two-point functions, and the two-point functions of the perturbations are given by the mode, the mod squared of the mode functions. So these zeta q and gamma q, these are the mode functions. And if you want to work out the power spectrum on superhorizon scales, they're given by the mod squared of the mode functions at late times. So what you do in standard inflation, the mode functions at early times, they're set by the Bunsen-Davis vacuum condition. You evolve them out to late times using the equations of motion, the classical equations of motion, and then you compute the mod squared at late times. That tells you the cosmological power spectrum. So that's just a standard inflationary story. Now, to make contact with holography, I'd like to rephrase this standard inflationary calculation in a slightly different way. To do this, I'd like to introduce response functions defined as follows. So basically, the response functions are this omega and this e, and they just connect the canonical momentum with the fluctuation itself. And so basically, you can show that the mod squared of the mode functions is related to the imaginary part of the response functions. So for the cosmologists among you, you remember that the quantum fields have to obey the canonical commutation relations, and that gives you these Wronskian relations for the mode functions. If you play around with the Wronskian relations for the mode functions, that's how you can prove these relations. So the upshot of all this is that the power spectrum are given by the mod squared of the mode functions at late times. So you can re-express the power spectrum in terms of the late time parts of these response functions. Okay? So the point is we can re-express the cosmological power spectra in terms of the response functions. This is going to be useful because the response functions are going to directly enter our holographic description. Okay, so now let's talk about this domain wall cosmology correspondence.
So why is it the inverse of the power spectrum?
So you have to play around. So I can show you afterwards. But basically, the Wronskian relations tell you that, for the scalars, it tells you that I is like pi zeta star minus zeta pi star. And then you just plug in the response functions, and then you have mod zeta squared imaginary part of response function equals I. And so I'll show you later. It's trivial. Yeah.
There are really two response functions for the metric.
That's correct. For the tensor modes, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I suppose basically,
you're assuming that they're equal.
I think they're equal, actually. Yeah.
If you don't like CPTI or...
That's right.
We'll come back.
Yes, I think they should be equal. We write gamma ij as some polarization vector times some.
So in principle, there's a difference. Right. And this is second grade. So there's really some dimensional parameters that, because the metric and scalar field have different dimensions. There's some powers
that are so I put a fast one. So for the purpose, where did I have the action somewhere? Yeah. So I'm taking the scalar field to be dimensionless.
Okay.
I've absorbed. There's a factor of kappa squared out front. So this scalar field here is dimensionless. The reason why I've done this is because this dimensionless combination has a direct interpretation in terms of holography. Basically, the boundary value of this dimensionless scalar field corresponds to a source for the dual scale operator in the QFT. So it's useful to use this dimensionless scalar field because it has a direct interpretation in terms of holography. So I just pulled that as a fast one because I didn't want to get stuck down, but that's right.
Would you do this calculation expanding action in second order so that everything's available in your S curves notion? At that level, it is true with the
response. I mean, you can. This is a trivial point, really. I mean, you could work with a scalar field that has dimensions and mass, but then you find that that would also have to continue under this domain one cosmology correspondence. So, but I can explain more of this afterwards. But it's nothing to worry about. So now I'm going to talk about domain wall cosmology correspondence. So I'd like to introduce these so-called domain wall spacetimes. So they're closely related to cosmological spacetimes. For the background, you know, the metric is just here. So if eta is minus 1, then it's just a usual cosmology background. If eta is plus 1, then you have a Euclidean domain wall background. I'm going to take the domain wall to be Euclidean. You could flip one of these coordinates to make it a Lorentzian, but for what we're going to do, it's most convenient to work with a Euclidean domain wall. The name domain wall spacetime is something of an unfortunate terminology. It basically dates back to earlier work by Townsend and Skanderis and various people where it had two copies of this spacetime, and then there really was a domain wall. But for the present purposes, there isn't actually a domain wall. We're just stuck with this unfortunate terminology due to historical reasons. But by domain wall spacetime, it simply means a metric of this form here with eta being plus 1. So z is a radial coordinate. Okay, so domain wall spacetimes are very important. They play a prominent role in holography. Domain wall spacetimes describe holographic RG flows. So the basic idea is that the radial evolution of the domain wall spacetime maps onto the normalization group flow of the dual quantum field theory. And the domain wall action is, again, just gravity in a scalar field. Okay, so now let's try and work out a correspondence between cosmologies and domain walls. And I want to find some correspondence that maps solutions of the background equations of motion onto each other, and also solutions of the perturbations onto each other. So if you go away and you work out the equations of motion for domain walls and cosmologies, you find this. The top line is just the background equations of motion. The bottom line is the equations of motion for the fluctuations. For the basically, this coordinate z, if it's a cosmology, eta is minus 1 and z is the proper time coordinate. If it's a domain wall, eta is plus 1 and z is basically the proper radial coordinate. So the dots in these equations mean differentiation with respect to z. And whether it's a cosmology or domain wall is determined by this parameter eta that appears explicitly in the equations. So the top line is just the standard, in cosmology, if you choose eta is minus 1, the top line is just the standard Friedmann equations written in a sort of first order form where we take the scalar field evolution to be monotonic. And then the bottom line is just clearly the fluctuation equations we had before. So if you look carefully at these equations, eta, this sign that tells you which whether you're looking at domain wall or cosmology, it only crops up here, multiplying kappa squared v. Kappa squared is the Newton's constant, remember. Kappa squared is 8 pi g. And it also appears multiplying the momentum squared term. So you Fourier transform the perturbations, and q squared is the momentum on the spatial coordinates. So let's introduce these analytically continued variables. So kappa bar squared, so the bar, any variable with a bar is going to refer to the domain wall spacetime is my notation. So kappa bar squared is minus kappa squared, and also q bar is minus iq. So if you take a cosmological solution written in terms of kappa and q, you can see that if you use this analytic continuation, it maps you to a domain wall solution expressed in terms of kappa bar and q bar. You start off with a cosmological solution where eta is minus 1. You do this analytic continuation, and that introduces a sign change here, here, and here, and that maps you to a solution of the domain wall equations of motion. So this is just a simple trick to take you from a cosmological solution to a domain wall solution, and it works with perturbations as well as the background. So I chose this bulk continuation because it has a clear interpretation in terms of dual QFT variables. You might have thought at first sight, why don't I continue time to radius coordinate, t is ir, or something like that. The reason why I don't think that's such a good way to proceed is that the radius coordinate, this time or radial coordinate, it doesn't appear in the dual quantum field theory. The dual QFT lives in one dimension less, so this radius or time coordinate disappears. More loosely speaking, you can think of the radial coordinate as being like the energy scale on the dual QFT, and considering that is a little bit disturbing. So I've chosen to continue Newton's constant because this has a very clear interpretation in terms of the dual QFT variables, which we'll see later in the talk. The other thing I've done is that I've chosen the sign of this continuation here. That could have been plus IQ. I chose the sign of this continuation so as to map the Bunch-Davis vacuum in cosmology onto the solution that's exponentially decaying in the interior of the domain wall. So the Bunch-Davis vacuum means that the modes go like this at early times, tau is basically the conformal time. And if I choose the continuation I've chosen, this maps onto this solution here, which is exponentially decaying in the interior of the domain wall, which is tau goes to minus infinity. So when you do holography, obviously you want solutions that are regular in the interior. So that forces the sign in this continuation. And also you can define response functions analogously for the domain wall as we did for cosmology. And the response functions for the domain wall are just given by this analytic continuation of the cosmological response functions.
So is the correspondence between domain walls and response to the background, is it unique?
No, so not entirely.
So it always exists because there is a function w there.
So basically, I mean, I didn't want to get too bogged down, but basically we're working in this formalism where things first order, so we're assuming the evolution of the scalar field is monotonic. So phi as a function of z is monotonic, and that means you can invert in principle to get z as a function of phi. Now the Hubble parameter h, you can think of that as a function of time, as a function of z. So because it's monotonic, you can automatically write it down as some function of the scalar field. You know, h is a function of z, and if z is a function of phi, then h is a function of phi, which I'm calling w.
So if
I'm
so, infracom, which is moving down the potential, and it's, I'm in the region.
So if you want to do the thing where it oscillates, then you'd have to do this. I'm working in the thing where it's piecewise monotonic, so you just split it up into little pieces.
But I'm doing more solutions in each small.
Yes, that's right. But like, you essentially, I'm just looking at the sort of monotonic phase. But again, these are technical issues.
Just to get the conceptual thing right. So you're not doing Euclidean continuation of general relativity. Continuation of general relativity of Newton's constant goes to minus Newton's
constant. Correct. And the momentum of the perturbation.
And you're doing it in a first-order formalism, so equivalently in a Hamiltonian formalism.
Yeah.
And so it's like taking the Hamiltonian constraint and changing the sign between the two terms of the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah. Flipping Newton's constant, exactly.
But in the solutions, T remains Z becomes T.
Z stays as Z. So Z is always, so A of Z goes to A of Z. So the scale factor doesn't change. It's always A of Z. It's just that Z has a different identity. It's either a time coordinate or a radius coordinate according to the sine of eta. I never continue. No. The reason why is because T and radius, you know, these aren't coordinates that appear in the dual quantum field theory. Whereas Newton's constant appears as, you know, the square of the number of colors in the dual QFT. We'll see this later. Okay. You will see that later, yes. Okay, so far I've just shown you how to map between a perturbed cosmological solution and a perturbed domain wall solution by flipping the sign of Newton's constant and by continuing the momentum in such a manner that you map Bunch-Davis vacuum to regular and interior solution.
Yeah, and what do you do to the cosmological constant?
So effectively nothing. So basically, if you had a cosmological constant, you could write it as, you know, minus 6 over L squared, where L is the, you know, the de Sitter radius. Nothing changes with that.
So
I don't change the sign of that. You know, exactly. If you think of Einstein's equation, G mu nu is like kappa squared lambda G mu nu. So you can flip lambda or you can flip the kappa squared. I'm flipping the kappa squared instead of the lambda. You can either flip the sign of the, you know, you can flip the sign of the cosmological. Yes, as long as it's a relative sign. You can put that relative sign in the lambda or you can put it in the Newton's constant. I'm putting the Newton's constant because that'll have a very clear interpretation of the dual QFT variables, as we'll see in the latter part of the talk. So perhaps I better just move on. I don't want to get behind time. So let's talk now about holographic RG flow spacetimes. So there are two classes of spacetimes where we understand, the two classes of domain wall spacetimes where the holographic interpretation is very clear. And these are the two classes of domain wall spacetimes we're going to focus on. So the first is, of course, you know, the most familiar one, asymptotically anti-de Sitter solutions. So asymptotically, the scale factor goes as e to the z, and you know, the phi goes to zero asymptotically. So these solutions describe a QFT that flows in the ultraviolet to a fixed point, and you know, the fixed point is described by a CFT that corresponds to the asymptotically ADS geometry. So under the domain wall cosmology correspondence, asymptotically ADS domain wall solutions are mapped to cosmologies that are asymptotically de Sitter. So at late times, towards the end of inflation, you've got an asymptote to a de Sitter geometry. The other class of spacetimes is actually rather more interesting. It's much more recently understood. So these are solutions, these are domain wall solutions whose geometry is asymptotically power law. So asymptotically, the scale factor goes as z to some power n, some constant. And, you know, phi behaves as here. So from a string theory perspective, you could obtain special cases. You know, for specific values of this parameter n, you can obtain these things from the near horizon limit of non-conformal brains. So for example, if, you know, if n is 7, then this corresponds to the D2 brain. So these solutions were fairly understood fairly recently by these papers Kostas, Skenderis, and Ingmar Kanitscheider and Marika Taylor. So these are recent papers here.
So the bulk is obtained from some truncation?
Yes, okay. So the way it works, if you want to understand in a nutshell how it works, you can think of starting off with anti-de Sitter space, or some space that's asymptotically anti-de Sitter in higher dimensions, and you can dimensionally reduce on a torus, and then you can end up with these spacetimes after you've done the dimensional reduction. So in a sense, a shortcut to find the holographic description of these spacetimes is to start off with a higher dimensional asymptotically ADS geometry where you understand how holography works, and then you dimensionally reduce on this torus, and you end up with these spacetimes and the lower dimensional spacetimes, and then you have to do an analytic continuation in this parameter n. So that's a shortcut to get these spacetimes, and that's described in Ingmar's paper there.
So back in cosmology,
yes,
greater than one would be inflation. Here that's required for regularity.
So this is a very fascinating question. So in cosmology, these things correspond to asymptotically power law inflation geometries, and power law inflation means that this power n is greater than 1. Now, of course, we would love to understand non-inflationary spacetimes where n is less than 1. You know, if n is, what, a half or two-thirds, you can talk about radiation-dominated universes, matter-dominated universes. One of my original hopes is that we'd be able to do holography for such universes. For technical reasons, the status quo right now is that we only understand the holographic formalism where n is greater than 1, which limits us to asymptotically power law inflation. Essentially, one way of thinking about it is the dimension of the torus on which you do this dimensional reduction goes negative if you take n as less than 1. But my gut feeling is that this is basically just a little technical problem. You know, when these guys did this paper, there wasn't really a clear motivation for looking at spacetimes with n as less than 1. Obviously, from a cosmological perspective, there's a very strong motivation. My feeling is that we can probably get around this technical problem if we think hard enough about it. So this is something I'd like to come back to at some point. But for now, we're just going to stick with n being greater than 1, because that's where we really understand the holographic description. So these solutions are dual to quantum field theories that have a single dimensional coupling constant. Okay, so let's just...
I mean, on the flip side, could it be positive? I mean, if it ends up being forced to have n greater than 1, I mean...
So it's not a deep... It's simply that in order to understand the holographic formalism, the holographic formalism they've constructed so far, it only works in this regime where n is greater than 1. My feeling is that that's really something of a technical restriction that just, you know, if you really push it and think hard, I'm pretty sure I would like to believe that you can extend it to n is less than 1. That would be very interesting, because then we just do holography for radiation or matter-dominated universes. And this is a, you know, pet thing I'd like to come back to at some point. So for now, I'd like to just give you, you know, again, I wasn't quite sure what the audience would compose on, so I'd like to give you a sort of brief review of the standard gauge gravity duality. You know, our version of holography is obviously based on the standard version. So there's a one-to-one, so you know, the usual idea of holography is there's a one-to-one correspondence between local gauge invariant operators in the boundary theory and supergravity modes in the bulk. So for example, the metric in the bulk, you know, this corresponds to the stress tensor in the dual quantum field theory, and scalar fields in the bulk, such as the inflaton, correspond to scalar operators in the boundaries, such as trace F squared. So the point is that you can work out correlation functions in the dual quantum field theory by looking at the asymptotics of the bulk solution. And you can also use the correspondence the other way around. If you know the quantum field theory correlation function, you can reconstruct the asymptotics of the bulk geometry. So one way to see this is, you know, let's look at the metric, which is dual to the stress tensor, which corresponds to the stress tensor in the boundary theory. So, you know, for an asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime, the metric has this asymptotic geometry here. So basically, you can do this radial expansion. So you think about sitting at the boundary and you expand inwards. So the leading term is this arbitrary metric, G naught ij. You know, this is arbitrary. You can choose this, and then you can sort of fill in the subleading terms as you go radially inwards. So G naught ij is the metric seen by the dual quantum field theory, and so it acts as the source for the dual stress tensor. These subleading terms here are entirely fixed in terms of G naught ij. If you look at the asymptotic behavior of the field equations, you can reconstruct what these terms are in terms of G naught ij, which you specified. And then the first undetermined subleading coefficient is this G2 sigma ij. It's only partially constrained by the asymptotic analysis of the field equations. And in holography, basically, G2 sigma ij is related to the one-point function for the dual stress tensor, like this. So if you're talking about an asymptotically ADS spacetime, 2 sigma is 3 in 4 dimensions. And if you're talking about these asymptotically power law spacetimes, the analysis is a little bit more complicated. You have to go to a different conformal frame. It's called the dual frame. And in this dual frame, you find that the asymptotics is, again, ADS. And so you know, this 2 sigma is given. It's related to that parameter n we saw earlier. So for asymptotically ADS spacetimes, 2 sigma is 3, so sigma is 3 halves. For asymptotically power law spacetimes, sigma is related to n, the power in the spacetime. It's not too important for what we're doing here, that's why I haven't put it explicitly. So basically the upshot is, let's look at this formula here. You know, if you know the bulk geometry, then you can read off the one-point function. Alternatively, if you know the one-point function, you can reconstruct the bulk geometry. Now, the point is that this remains true even when you go to the regime where the gravity description is strongly coupled and deep in the interior, the description in terms of low energy fields such as the metric and the inferton breaks down. The point is that asymptotically, you still recover a metric description, and gauge gravity duality requires that the value of this subleading coefficient, G2 sigma, coming from stringy dynamics in the interior, that has to match what you get from the dual QFT at weak coupling. So essentially, this is what we're going to do. You know, we're going to use gauge gravity. We're going to use the dual QFT at weak coupling to compute, you know, to compute the correlation function. Then we're going to compute this coefficient here and reconstruct the bulk geometry.
Sorry, I don't understand the assumption here. So you're saying So but here's an assumption that this equation which you've written, GIJRX, it is valid even in the strong.
So the point is, you've got to have something that takes you, you've got to have some dictionary that takes you between asymptotics of the bulk geometry and the data of the dual QFT. So even in the regime where gravity is strongly coupled and you've got stringy dynamics deep in the interior, asymptotically, as you go towards the boundary, you recover a metric description that has this form here. And then you can relate this coefficient to the, you know, the one-point function of dual QFT. So even in the regime where gravity is strongly coupled, you've got to have some translation between the asymptotics of the bulk geometry and the QFT data. So the idea is that this holds true even in the regime where gravity is strongly coupled and the dual QFT is weakly coupled. So in order to do cosmology, we're just going to reconstruct this asymptotic classical geometry using the dual QFT.
So what principle determines how far you're able to go in suspension? Or it doesn't make any sense at all because the metric is purely quantum mechanical involved. I understand pulling off the leading term. I can understand pulling off the first derivative of the leading term.
There's two coefficients, isn't there? The second order equation of motion. There's this term you fix, and there's that term you fix, and the rest is in principle.
It's only asymptotic.
Yeah, this is only asymptotic. It won't work all the way.
So what's the meaning of asymptotic? I mean, so I would say the meaning of asymptotic
large
R, is roughly speaking the components of the Einstein equations that you can pull back as equations by forms into the boundary should hold, and the components of Einstein's equations which are perpendicular to the boundary may not hold because.
I think it's better just to say, you know, we just find a series solution of Einstein's equations about the boundary. Classical, yes. We find a series solution of the classical Einstein equations of motion about the boundary, about R goes to infinity.
So to make this work, we have to assume there's some region asymptotically where the Einstein equations work.
Emerge, yeah.
Despite the fact that way far away from that, at least in the UDS context, they may make no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, what you're doing is the expansion is only near the boundary.
Yes. Yeah, right. That's correct. Yeah. And deep in the interior, you know, the metric description may break down.
Yeah.
But then everywhere asking the same question. I mean, the Einstein equations are the Einstein equations. So if you fixed everything you need to determine the solution of the Einstein equations in the interior, there is a solution of the Einstein equations in the interior. And doesn't that contradict your expectation that the Einstein equations are failing?
So I'm working in this regime where gravity is strongly coupled. So Einstein's equations, you know, there's a metric description asymptotically, but deep in the interior, you know, there's no metric description of space.
Right.
So I have to go to stringy dynamics.
So why do you expect to be able to fix boundary conditions asymptotically?
So using the dual QFT, that's the point. So this is the point in holography. The point is that you can reconstruct this coefficient here using the dual quantum field theory.
This is a statement
of the duality, essentially.
I understand the assumptions.
Well, this
let me put it differently. Is there any observable you can measure in the boundary theory that reflects the fact that the quantum fluctuations in the metric in the interior are order one. So
what we're going to do is we're going to use the dual quantum field theory to reconstruct this asymptotic geometry and cosmological observables such as the power spectrum, which we can measure. We're going to find predictions that are quite unique and distinctive to this scenario we're considering. So that would enable us, in principle, to distinguish it from other scenarios where gravity is valid all the way into early times, such as standard inflation. But the point is we're really interested in just reconstructing this asymptotic region towards the end of inflation, where you have a classical gravity description emerges. And the point is we're going to be able to reconstruct this space-time. I'm not really interested in the deep interior. I'm not really interested in this regime at very early times. Because, well, ultimately we would be, because, you know, we want to understand the Big Bang singularity. Now, if you take this description where the gravity description is strongly coupled and the metric breaks down at early times, then that will tell you something very interesting about the initial singularity in cosmology.
Sure.
But as a first approximation, what we're going to try and do is understand how to compute things that we can actually measure. So what we can actually measure is the cosmological power spectrum. So the first thing I'm going to try and do is I want to understand this scenario. I want to make predictions for things we can measure, like the cosmological power spectrum. And to do that, I just need to understand the late-time asymptotics. But to address more fundamental questions like the Big Bang, then we really would want to understand, you know, what happens in this deep interior region at very, very early times. So ultimately, I'd like to try and understand that. But for now, we just want to, as a first pass through this problem, we want to understand things we can compute, things we can measure observationally, such as the power spectrum. And these only require an understanding of what this, reconstructing this asymptotic classical geometry.
Okay, well,
Just
one main question. So aren't you imposing or assuming something when you think that expansion is valid? Wouldn't you have log r terms or things like that?
I think that is in specific dimensions, even at order.
Oh, well, you can work this out. Oh, well, yes. So I mean, you know, obviously, the form of this expansion depends on dimensionality. I'm taking the bulk to be four-dimensional. You know, there's no conformal anomaly in this dimension, so there's no logarithmic terms in this expansion. You know, if you go to odd bulk dimensions, there'll be logarithmic terms in this expansion as well. And, you know, they're related to the conformal anomaly. Okay. So let's push through because I want to get through this. So we want to compute two-point functions in the dual quantum field theory because these are going to correspond to the power spectrum in cosmology. So if you want to compute two and higher point functions, then you just differentiate the one-point function with respect to the source the appropriate number of times and then set the source to the background value. So if you want to compute two-point functions, then you differentiate the one-point function with respect to the source and then you set the source to the background value afterwards. So the point is, you know, if you want to work out the two-point function, you need to know this subleading component, you need to know this subleading component of the metric as a functional of the boundary metric g naught ij, but we only need to know it to linear order. So to compute two-point functions, we only need to look at the bulk fluctuation equations to linear order. So that's a nice simplification. So on general grounds, you can show the two-point function for the stress tensor admits this decomposition here. So basically, this big pi ij is the transverse traceless projection operator, and these little pi's are the transverse projection operator there. So basically, the two-point function of the stress tensor splits into two parts. This is like the transverse traceless part, A, and B is like the trace part of the two-point function. And we're going to see in a moment that basically this transverse traceless part here is going to relate to the power spectrum for the tensor modes in cosmology because these are transverse traceless. And this trace part is going to be related to the power spectrum for the scalars in cosmology. So summarizing, basically we work with this radial Hamiltonian formulation of holographic normalization developed by Kostas Skenderis and Yannis Papadimitriou in these papers here. And we were able to show that for both asymptotically ADS domain walls and for asymptotically power law domain walls, then these coefficients in the decomposition of the stress tensor, so these A and B, are just related to particular components of the domain wall response functions. So if you work out domain wall response functions, you can read off from them what the dual stress tensor is. So the subscript basically involves taking a particular term with the appropriate scaling asymptotic expansion. Now, I was asked to provide a few more details on this. I don't want to get too technical, so I've just got two slides which give you a little bit more of an indication how I got these results. But, you know, you don't have to follow this if you don't like. These results are the crucial point. So in the Hamiltonian formalism, so previously I showed you how we could radially expand the metric about the boundary. In the Hamiltonian formalism, we replace this radial expansion of the metric by a covariant expansion in eigenfunctions of the dilatation operator. So basically you can prove that asymptotically the radial derivative is equal to the dilatation operator in the dual QFT. And so the point about this replacement of this radial expansion with this covariant dilatation expansion is that it's covariant. So basically the dual one-point function is now given by the canonical momentum, in particular a piece with dilatation weight 3 of the bulk canonical momentum. And for these asymptotically parallel spacetimes, as I was saying before, we have to go to this dual frame where everything looks like asymptotically ADS. So just to give you a sort of brief idea about where this formula came from, you know, if you think of quantum field theory and we've got these two sources here, you know, this source is the stress tensor and this source is the dual scalar operator. So, you know, the boundary value of the metric source is the stress tensor and the boundary value of the inflaton, you know, that source is the dual scalar operator. You know, if you do a linear variation of the sources, then the variation of the one-point function is given by the two-point functions. And if you insert the decomposition we have for this two-point function, you the transverse traceless piece comes out here with the, you know, with the tensor modes here, and then the trace piece comes out with the trace part of the scalar metric. So the formalism says that if we're going to perturb the one-point function, we've got to perturb the bulk canonical momentum. So if you perturb the bulk canonical momentum and play around with the Einstein constraint equations and use the domain wall response function definitions, you can show that the variation of the one-point function is given by this expression here. And then you just pick off terms of the appropriate dilatation weight and compare with this expression here. So, you know, if you look at this term here, A has dilatation weight minus 1, so the piece of dilatation weight 3 is given by E naught, and that's got to match A. So that's how you get that formula there. So that's just a very, if people are interested in the technical details of this Hamiltonian holographic normalization formula, I'd be very happy to discuss this afterwards.
So the thing that's puzzling me is that your metric is always classical, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so
classical gravity corresponds to this QFT. That's
the where can I see the expectation values of, I don't know, two-point relationship of metric, for example?
In the bulk. You can't. So the bulk, yes. Yeah. So basically, you know, we've got this QFT in this large end limit, and that corresponds to classical gravity in the bulk side. You know, the large end limit suppresses loop corrections on the gravity side of the correspondence. So I'll show you in a bit how we connect to cosmology and the power spectrums in cosmology. So the upshot of all that was just that the two-point functions in the dual quantum field theory, they're given by the domain wall response functions. A particular piece of the domain wall response functions. Okay, so let's put this all together now. You know, let's go from cosmology to QFT. So remember, in cosmology, we want to work out the power spectrum. We showed how you could express the power spectra in terms of the late time part of the response functions. I showed you how to map the cosmological response functions to the domain wall response functions via this analytic continuation. And I showed you how to get to the two-point function of the QFT in terms of those response functions. So we can put the whole thing together now and go from the power spectrum in cosmology to the two-point functions of the dual QFT. And, you know, this is our major result. So you've got your dual QFT. It's got this two-point function of the stress tensor. There's a transverse traceless piece, and then there's a trace piece. And the cosmological power spectra for scalars and for tensors are here. You know, as you'd expect, the transverse traceless piece of the stress tensor two-point function, that determines the tensor power spectrum, and the trace piece of the two-point function determines the power spectrum for the scalar modes in cosmology. So this just came from putting all of this correspondence together. And this is our key.